You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Back to school shopping season is here, and technology is becoming a bigger part of those lists, and scammers know that. Coming up, we'll tell you how to protect yourself when you buy those items and maybe how to save some money on everything else. Now, speaking of school, the state has come out with guidance for the upcoming school year to help protect students and staff from COVID-19. According to the State Departments of Health Services and Public Instruction, masks are strongly recommended. They're also encouraging social distancing, testing, and vaccinations for people who are eligible. For some students in Wisconsin, school begins 3 weeks from today. In a little bit, we'll talk about how parents can help get kids ready. First, we're going to focus on the recommendations from the DHS and DPI, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the state's guidance for the school year? Do you want your kids' school district to adopt these policies to require masks? Do you want to see vaccination requirements where available? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Madeline Fox is Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter based in Milwaukee. Maddie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, we're looking at in-person education, even for a lot of schools that were not in person for a lot of last year. Did you get a sense of confidence from state officials that we can have a healthy school year this time around?
That's kind of a tough question. I think that definitely state officials are pushing for an in-person school year, an all-in-person school year, and pushing for a healthy school year. But I do think that the Delta variant is causing a lot of concern, as is just the fact that kids under 12 can't be vaccinated yet. And so there was already some concern going into the school year about whether we might see transmission among younger kids. And certainly the Delta variant has amped that up. But I think what the message that we're hearing from state policymakers is that if we put certain precautions in place, it is definitely feasible to have a more safe school year and an in-person school year as much as possible.
Before we start digging into these recommendations from these state departments, Maddie, a key point here, recommendations, not requirements. Yes. Can you talk about that?
I sure can. So and we saw this last year with the Department of Public Instruction's recommendations as well, that they can highly recommend certain things. They can put out a whole laundry list of things that school districts should consider in setting their standards and their procedures and their precautions for the year. But they don't have the power, or at least are not willing to exercise the power to make sure that schools do that. That was a little bit of a moot point last year because we had a statewide mask mandate in effect. And so that meant that schools had to wear masks because everybody had to wear masks. But this time around, it is very much up to the school districts, and in part because of some of the political pushback we saw last year and the fact that we're all kind of tired of the new COVID normal. You are seeing more school districts this year deciding to disregard those recommendations.
Digging.
And they can do that because, as you said, they are just recommendations.
So with that in mind, let's look at some of these specific recommendations. According to this guidance, who should be wearing masks, where and when?
So the guidance says that everybody should be wearing a mask, actually, even if you're vaccinated. If you're inside, for sure, from what I'm hearing from health professionals is that when kids are outside at recess, for example, and of course, when they're eating lunch, you know, there are times when kids just can't be masked. But the idea is, especially in light of the Delta variant and in light of the CDC recommendations that we saw as a result of rising cases, they are suggesting that everybody wears a mask.
And then that's masks. How about physical distancing? We've seen 6 feet. We've seen 3 feet. What are we hearing from the state?
So the official recommendation at this point is 3 feet. However, that's sort of with a caveat that more distance is definitely better. More distance will give you a better, if you'll pardon the pun, breathing room for the fact that droplets will move around and sometimes, you know, kids aren't wearing masks. So one of the other things to keep in mind is that 3 feet is when everybody's masked. Once you get into situations like in the lunchroom where kids have their masks down, DPI and the CDC recommend pulling it back out to that 6 feet or more if possible.
We're talking to WPR education reporter Madeline Fox, looking at new recommendations from the state's health and education departments for back-to-school season and COVID-19 safety. Okay, how about vaccines? How are these state departments treating that issue? Vaccine mandates, contentious around the country. What are we hearing from these state departments?
That's another in the recommendations bucket from the state departments for schools. We are seeing actually some I think private and independent schools that have the capacity to do this are saying that school teachers and staff need to be vaccinated or submit to testing once or twice a week. But generally speaking, there's a lot of encouragement. And in fact, we're seeing, you know, schools hosting vaccine clinics because they are good community sites to have those events and that families can easily get to because they do that during this school year, of course. And so we're seeing an encouragement of vaccination for that 12 and up group, but not a requirement so far.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Blue River. Bill, hi.
Yes, I was just concerned about the vaccination with the children. It just seems like they're, even if they do get COVID, their recovery rate is extremely well. And so why do we subject our children to I don't trust a lot of this stuff with these vaccinations. I don't even refer to them as a vaccination. I refer to them as an experimental. They haven't even been approved by the FDA.
Bill, so, thanks a lot for the call. Of course, they've been approved for emergency use. Waiting for that likely a full approval within the next few weeks, probably. But Bill brings up a good point, especially for kids 12 and under, not currently eligible to get a vaccine at all. Larger, better recovery rates, less risk of the illness. But as you're saying, Maddie, Delta variant is raising concerns about kids, more of them getting sick now. Did these guidelines address that, the 12 and under risk because of Delta variant without vaccines available?
I think it just was an underscoring of the fact that the unvaccinated people are more vulnerable. I mean, we saw even as vaccines started to roll out largely across the country, to older age groups, you know, first to the 18s and ups, and then we brought it down to 12-year-olds and 12 to 18 as well. We started seeing the infection rate falling among some of the older age groups and growing among some of the younger age groups just because they didn't have that vaccination protection. So I think really it is just an underscoring of the fact that if you're not vaccinated, you are at risk. And so unfortunately, that has to include all of our kids under 12 for the time being.
And what have you been hearing from school districts, Maddie, around the state about how they're getting ready to bring kids back in after this summer?
Well, they've got a lot to think about. I mean, certainly there are these precautions. So a lot of them are planning mask mandates for just some groups of students, just unvaccinated students, some of them for all students and all staff, like the CDC recommends. And then also thinking about other precautions that we saw last year as well. So distancing, cleaning, improving ventilation. Actually, a lot of schools are looking into, and actually have been over the past year, looking into ways to upgrade their HVAC systems so that they're not circulating air that might have not just COVID, actually, but all kinds of other diseases and illnesses that spread in schools. As anyone who's been spent a lot of time around elementary schoolers will tell you, they get sick a lot. So we are seeing that. We're also seeing, you know, schools are trying to get back to a little more normal and get back on a regular pace of learning after a year that was actually disrupted for a lot of kids, whether that was because of virtual learning or temporary school closures because of COVID spread, or just the fact that it was a really traumatizing year for a lot of families and a really difficult year for a lot of families. And so trying to find ways to support those students socially and emotionally and academically.
Maddie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Madeline Fox is Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter based in Milwaukee. We talked to her about the state's recommendations for the upcoming school year, including masking, social distancing, COVID testing, and more. Coming up, we'll look at how parents can help get their kids ready for the new school year emotionally. And you could tell us what it's like at your home at 800-642-1234. How are your kids feeling about returning to the classroom? Are they worried? Are they excited? Are you going to keep them at home? How do they do with wearing masks and keeping distance? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the upcoming school year. A lot of students are going to be returning to the classroom, this time with the highly contagious COVID-19 Delta variant going around. A Officials at the state health and education agencies are urging everyone at schools to wear masks and take other precautions. It may be a stressful time, especially for kids. Our next guest has some advice on how parents can help their children readjust to in-person learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know how your kids are feeling about going back to school, what you've been doing to help put them at ease. If you're one of those students yourself, love to hear from you. Or if you're getting ready at your school, if you work there, what are you doing to help your kids make the transition back to school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jenny Brownson is a senior lecturer in teaching and learning at the School of Education at UW-Milwaukee. She used to teach fourth and fifth grade in Milwaukee Public Schools. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Well, back to school time, I know in normal times, Jenny, can be stressful enough. These are not normal times. How much added stress and anxiety can this situation give to students and families?
Well, I mean, look at what, you know, the previous speaker spoke to, right? We don't even know what's going to happen for sure. It looks like we're at 6 feet distance. We're masked up. Schools have to make the tough decision on whether we go back face to face or if it's going to be a hybrid situation. So just even the uncertainty is tough to know. So it can be pretty hard, especially when you're 10 years old and entering fourth grade.
What are some of the most important things parents could be doing right now to help get their kids ready for going back likely to in-person school right now?
Well, I like to call it the pandemic as opportunity. If we can look at it maybe just a little bit more positively, this really is an opportunity for parents to lean in, to get to know their kids even more, to ask them how they're feeling, to ask them what they think about what's going on. So in school anyway, we know this, right? We know this as teachers and educators, that inquiry is so important. Kids need to ask questions as they move along anyway in regular times. So encourage them to be inquisitive and to ask questions, and help them to identify how they're feeling, identify the emotions. That's really important too, and that helps to dissipate them along the way.
When a kid expresses a negative emotion about school, worry, fear, whatever it might be, how can parents talk to them about that and not, I guess, diminish those feelings?
Well, again, I think it's important just to have a regular time that you speak to your child about these kinds of things. Like, this is when we're going to talk about how you're feeling, and you get to unpack that together a little bit. And it's okay to acknowledge the feelings. We also don't want to go in the direction, though, of, you know, oh my gosh, this pandemic, it's getting kind of scary and that kind of thing. But we can say, look, it's okay. Things are uncertain right now, but we have people working on this, right? We have people asking questions and trying to figure out vaccines and how to handle things like going back to school face to face.
I understand you recommend that students and parents actually try some role-playing exercises to give kids an idea of what to expect. What's that going to look like?
Well, I think it's important to, first of all, recognize our audience, right? Kids are already creative and inquisitive and curious. And we remember when our kids are 3 and 4 and 5, they're always role playing, right? I'm the mom, you're the dad, let's do this. So go ahead and open that up for your kids. Role play a situation. So let's talk about what this is going to look like when you get back to school. And we have a mask. So maybe practice with a mask on for an hour, and then maybe try it for a couple hours, and just kind of work up to that time in September when you get back to school. And you can kind of practice what does 6 feet look like at home in the living room? And then they have an idea of what that might look like in school.
We're talking to Jenny Brownson from the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, talking about getting kids ready for the new school year with an extra dose of anxiety, maybe, for a lot of kids because of the pandemic, because a lot of them did school from home last year. Maybe this is their first time in a new school. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have an experience to share in your family, at your school, or a question for our guest. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Willa is with us in Sheboygan. Willa, hello.
Hello there.
What did you want to bring up, Willa?
So I am a 4K teacher at a nature-based preschool, and I just wanted to put my bid forward for nature-based education because last year, in the midst of the pandemic, other schools in my district had to close periodically, but ours was able to stay in person the whole year, and no one got sick. And maybe that was because we were outside more, maybe because we were masking inside, but it was just a wonderful experience all said and done. So I feel very fortunate for that.
Willa, thanks a lot for the call. I can vouch for the value of getting me outside a lot during the pandemic. Jenny, could you talk about the value for kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So what Willa is talking about is what we call experiential learning. So really getting out there, being kinesthetic and moving around and trying different things. And really, like she was saying, a good place to do that is outside. I know a lot of summer programs here at UWM have thought, well, let's just put them outside and maybe that would, you know, help in terms of the safety. So there's definitely opportunities to do that for sure.
Thanks a lot for that call, Willa, at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts, Jenny, for teachers watching that new crew of kids show up in their classroom and being able to reach out? Now, this isn't one-on-one necessarily, but being able to reach out and help deal with some of those anxieties that may surround return.
Well, I think I'll go back to the role play. I mean, when I was a classroom teacher in MPS, it was all about trying things out. And that way we can feel within ourselves, what does this really look like? And what is it going to feel like? And then give them the opportunity to say, okay, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm feeling. And hey, I mean, that's literacy based, right? So they can write about it. They can record themselves and talk about it. They can stay 6 feet distance and talk about it with somebody else. Also, I would say for teachers and certainly for parents to collaborate as much as possible. Again, we want, you know, this to happen anyway during a regular school year. But really make sure that line of communication is open. What does that mean? Is it email? Is it some kind of online platform? So, and parents offer to help if you can ask how can you help in some way. And that I have found keeps those lines open and then people know what to expect.
Let's bring on another caller now. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to know, I've got a nephew who's 17 now. He just turned 17 a couple weeks ago, but he won't go get the vaccine because he heard a bunch of junk from his grandfather, so he won't go get this vaccine now. Now, would that be something, because you've got the younger kids, too, that can't get it, you know, under 11 or whatever, but or whatever it is, but can you explain, like, if you had someone that refused to get vaccinated, would you, like, just maybe, because I'm just the aunt, would you just maybe, like, leave them at home? They wouldn't get to go to school because that kind of situation.
Samantha, thanks a lot for that call. I don't know if you have a health recommendation, Jenny, because you're coming from the education school there, but do you have thoughts for families who might be have internal conflict over the precautions they're going to take with the school you're approaching?
First of all, I would say that is, completely normal. I think as parents, we already have, you know, those internal conflicts, you know, when our kids first start school, when they go on to the milestones of, you know, middle school, high school, that kind of thing. So just, first of all, be gentle with yourself around that. And you have to do what you feel is right around, the vaccinations for sure. But schools are making these hard decisions in terms of, you know, how to help kids be safe. We have these vaccinations now. I think what's important, Rob, is that, you know, we have, like I mentioned earlier about inquiry, we have these scientists working on vaccinations or pandemics and what that looks like. I mean, that's very academic work, right? And kids are working their way up to this. So, you know, just have those kinds of conversations. Like, these scientists are meeting all over the globe, not just in the United States, on how to fix this problem that we're having. And so that kids can, you know, kind of talk about that and work up to that and that kind of thing. So that can be a very academic endeavor.
Thanks for that call, Samantha. In our last minute or so, Jenny, can you leave us with some maybe some inspiration or encouragement as we count down toward opening day of school?
Well, I think, again, our kids tell us what they need, even though they might not use words, but ask them. And they are incredibly creative beings. Help them lean into an art form that they particularly love. That is just really helps open up their cognitive pathways. And just remember, you know, we can talk about what school's going to be like. And when we get there, it might be a little different. Keep talking about it. Have a daily spot where, even if you don't see your child after school, keep a journal so you can talk back and forth. And remember, you can always give an air hug at school or at home.
Jenny, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Jenny Brownson, senior lecturer in teaching and learning at the School of Education at UW-Milwaukee. We talked to her today about how parents can help their kids readjust to life in the classroom. Earlier, WPR education reporter Madeline Fox told us about the state's guidance for the next school year. Coming up on a related topic, want to save a few bucks on your back-to-school shopping? We'll get some tips, plus some advice on how to avoid being scammed, especially for those big-ticket, high-technology items that are a bigger and bigger part of back-to-school every single year. By the way, we've got an online conversation going right now. We invited you to share the movies that make you cry. You can let us know, and we'll share some of those in the week to come. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and share yours, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about an organization in Milwaukee that offers free mental health care to people in need. Now, after a year of remote learning, technology has become a big part of students' educational needs. And it's expected to stay that way even as most of them get ready to return to classrooms in a few weeks. One market research firm says digital learning tools are replacing traditional school supplies, with technology sales up 37%, and nearly half of consumers want to buy that high-tech stuff online. But the selection may not be as good as in past years because of a shortage of essential supplies like computer chips. What does that all mean? Well, scammers are taking notice, and they're ready to pounce on unsuspecting buyers. Jim Temer is CEO and president of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here as always, Rod.
Well, as I'm sure you'll note, we should always be on the lookout for scammers, but does it seem to be getting worse these days, especially for back-to-school sales?
Well, you said it in your intro, high demand and low supply, so there's going to be people scrambling out there. You know, computer chips are limited right now, supply lines aren't where they should be, so people are going to be out there looking for what they need for their students, what they need for their children, and it might not be there. So that's when scammers really make it. They will put fake websites out there. They'll claim large discounts. They'll say whatever they can say so they can either get your credit card number or just get some quick cash. The website comes down. It comes up the next day with a different address.
What are red flags that we should watch for when we're looking to buy that computer, say, online?
Well, it's always best to shop with someone you know, a familiar retailer. All of these things are big ticket items and major investments. So even things like repair policies, return policies, when you're looking at a website, the first thing you do is you look at the address, make sure it is who you think it is, and it's not a little misspelling or something that sounds different, because scammers will throw up website names that look almost exactly like legitimate ones. A real simple thing, too, is it should start with an HTTPS. That S means secure, or it'll have a little padlock on it. But just that's the very first and an easy thing. And then look for policies. What is the return policy, shipping policy, all those things? A lot of times scammers, when they just throw up a website, don't even bother to do that. And, you know, we always say if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that applies here as well. A lot of these computers, a lot of companies don't offer deep discounts. And if you're seeing something that's 50% off, 75% off, either it's a scam or maybe it's outdated tech that they're trying to peddle on you and claiming that it's up to date.
In your recent release on back to school scams, you say we should do our technology shopping now instead of waiting. Why is that a good idea?
Because of the shortages, because of supply shortages. And you've got a lot of, you know, every student is going back to school just about, either virtually or in the classroom, and they need the technology. So there's going to be a big rush for it. I mean, hopefully some people have this stuff already, but there's a deadline to it. So people need to go early and not wait till the last minute. And that's when you're emotional, you need something, you can't find it anywhere, and you're more apt to fall for a scam.
Suppose we think we have been scammed. We made that order on that dubious website for that deal that's too good to be true, and we're not getting results. What do we do then?
Well, if you didn't receive anything or you received something you did not order, contact your credit card company, first of all. And that's, you should always buy with a credit card, because there are built-in protections that sometimes debit cards or other forms of payment do not have. And you can dispute the charges. And if you did not receive what you bought with that credit card, you won't be liable for the full price. Also, if you're using a delivery service or, you know, like an Amazon, something like that, contact them, because there are so many suppliers on Amazon. They, you know, do the best they can, but there are some scammers out there. Amazon's customer service should work with you as well. But again, unfortunately, then you still need to buy the computer or tablet or whatever it is that you're shopping for. Of course, you can always contact the BBB. We've got our scam tracker, and it's like a crowdsourcing tool. We take information from folks all over North America, and we put scam information in there that you can see what's going on. We share that with law enforcement. So there's some things you can do to save your money, and there's some things you can do to try not to be scammed.
And Jim, that half-off deal probably isn't legit on a computer, but are there ways, especially for educational shopping, that we can save at least a little bit of money when we're doing this high-tech back-to-school shopping?
Well, you bet. And some of it is low tech, right? Everybody needs back to school clothes. The retailers out there are really eager for shoppers to come back in. You know, masks, no masks, whatever it is, use your hand sanitizer, social distancing. Stores are offering some big sales on traditional items, you know, clothing, to get people to come back into the stores. We talked about the big ticket items. You know, those you want to research as much as possible. You know, some also places have sales tax free weekends for back to school goods. Look for that. Discounts. You can even ask discounts. Sometimes schools offer those through student IDs, or shops will offer those if you have a student and you can get a discount. Also, you could buy in bulk for school supplies. Maybe there's some other parents in your neighborhood or in your school you want to go in with. And you can, of course, buy in bulk, and the cost is less. We all know that the online shopping, as we mentioned earlier, is big. It's up over 30% this year over last year. And you just have to be careful for the ads that you're going to see. As soon as you start searching, you know, for computers or anything online, you're going to see it in your social media feeds. You're going to see it on banner ads across other websites. Just be very careful when you're clicking on ads that you aren't downloading anything you don't want in your computer that could be harmful. But as always, do your homework. You can vet any company you want at BBB.org. Or do other Google searches for them. Just take your time, enjoy it. Hopefully it's going to be a fantastic school year for all these students and their parents.
And finally, Jim, what receipts should we keep, and for how long?
Well, keep all your receipts, especially for some of this tech stuff. And make sure, you know the repair or return policies. Now this is just personally, I'm not a big believer in the extended warranties, buying those. Some people do. And your receipts, you want to keep them for, you know, you can keep them for 90 days. You can keep them for a year. It depends what you're buying. If I'm taking my kids out for a pair of jeans, you know, they're going to have holes in the knees and I won't need those receipts anymore. I'll need another pair of blue jeans.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
All right, my pleasure. Take care.
That's Jim Temer, CEO and president of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Talk to them about how to avoid being ripped off on back to school shopping, especially for the more expensive technology supplies, and how to save some money on the other stuff, too. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg talking with the author of a new biography on Milwaukee Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo. It was released yesterday.
The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions for the first time in 50 years.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
And Giannis Antetokounmpo is the superstar at the heart of the team. Not only does he have a national championship and two MVP trophies under his belt, but there's also a new biography on him. I recently talked with the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's about Antetokounmpo's Greek upbringing and his journey to American basketball stardom.
My name is Miran Fader, and I'm a staff writer at The Ringer.
Fader says Antetokounmpo was born in Sapolia, a neighborhood of Athens, Greece. She says life was tough. His parents had migrated from Nigeria, and they were undocumented. So finding work was hard.
So the parents would then bring the kids to sell items on the street or at upscale beaches and try to do whatever they could to put food on the table. And, you know, oftentimes they just wouldn't eat. So it was really, really tough. However, there was a lot of joy as well.
Antetokounmpo started playing basketball at age 13. He couldn't play on the elite local teams because of his immigration status, but some NBA scouts started to take notice anyway. By 2013, an 18-year-old Antetokounmpo was a scrawny but intriguing outsider as the NBA draft approached.
So the Milwaukee Bucks are choosing at number 15, and they decide to take a swing because it's Milwaukee.
With the 15th pick in the 2013 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Antetokounmpo.
And you hope to get lucky, but you expect disappointment. You don't know if this Greek kid is going to work out, but he's really tall and he's charismatic and maybe he might be okay.
Antetokounmpo ended up being more than just okay. And Milwaukee was a great fit because the team allowed him time to get acclimated to life in the NBA and the U.S.
And not having the pressure of coming in, being deified as the superstar, enabled him to grow. The only pressure that Giannis felt was, how do I provide money for my family? How do I get my family to come to America? You know, his pressures were different than the average NBA rookie.
Fader says taking care of his family was so important to Antetokounmpo because of how tight-knit they had always been.
Giannis grew up watching how his dad would pretend he wasn't hungry and give his portions to his sons. And Giannis's brothers were his best friends, his comrades. They were always laughing. They always shared everything. There was no arguments because everything was communal.
The love that Antetokounmpo had for his family was on display in 2019 when he got emotional while accepting his first MVP award. He also thanked his teammates that night and the city of Milwaukee.
And I think the thing that endears fans to Giannis most and Giannis to this city is that these fans watched him grow up. They liked that he wasn't crowned king at age 13. And they liked that this came out of nowhere. That's the ultimate lesson of all from people that come from Milwaukee. You work hard and dream big. And Giannis has done that.
And now Antetokounmpo has two MVPs and a championship. And he signed a contract extension, so his future is in Milwaukee. So what does Fader think that future might look like?
Keep in mind, Giannis is 26 years old, and he is just beginning to mature, not just into a global basketball superstar, but into a man, a father. And I think we're going to see him use his platform and his voice in bigger ways beyond the basketball court. I think Giannis is primed to become more. I think he's going to share more of himself.
Miran Fader, is a staff writer at The Ringer and the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll talk to the founder of an organization in Milwaukee that offers free mental health care services to Indigenous and underserved populations. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An organization in Milwaukee provides free mental health care for Indigenous and marginalized people. HIR, that's H-I-R, Wellness Institute, provides free individual and family therapy, occupational therapy, and more. Leah S. Denny is the CEO and clinical director of HIR Wellness Institute, which she founded in 2017. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you, Rob, for having me.
Well, you have a background in mental health counseling. What led you to decide to move beyond your own individual practice and start HIR Wellness?
Yeah, thank you for that question. When I was in my, I have over 20 years working in our mental health field in just various forms. And in my journey in mental health, I realized that there was a lack of cultural responsiveness and humility and a heavy focus on the individualism versus a collective experience within community. And so as I went into my clinical work and went into my master's degree, I was looking at adverse childhood experiences. I think a lot of people at this point might know about that over 20-year-old study of ACEs and looks at what childhood traumas you had experienced before the age of 18. And in that period, I was looking at the data and I was seeing that less than 1% of our Native people were represented in the data collections that they had. And I wanted to understand better why that was, because I know that we have many Native people living both on reservations and off reservation. In Milwaukee alone, the largest population of Native people live here in Milwaukee for the state of Wisconsin. And so I was curious on why I didn't really see the representation of our Indigenous communities in these types of questionnaires or surveys, if you will. And so I wanted to also understand the impact of historical trauma and what was the connection, what was the link between the impact of historical trauma as intergenerational trauma that becomes transgenerational trauma transmission, and how did that then influence higher ACE scores that might be perceived in our communities. And that research was my master's thesis at Mount Mary University. And when I was there, I thought maybe I'd be able to meet about 20 people and talk to them about my research. And I ended up speaking to over 200 people throughout the state of Wisconsin that are Native, that are both living on and off and in between reservation. And in that experience, I ended up having really meaningful conversations around the impact of trauma that really rooted itself in colonization, genocide, and the residential boarding school experience. And so as I continue to learn more about our communities, I myself am Hawaiian. My family is Hawaiian, Oneida, and Ojibwe. So we are, I like to say, an intertribal group here. And I knew that there was a pain that often in our mental health intakes was not being captured. And I wanted to better understand what we needed to do to really address the impact of intergenerational trauma.
And Leah,
and
I wanted
through
to...
that, yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned you saw as a problem kind of the individual focus of therapy. And I think if people picture therapy, whether they've done it or just seen it on TV, it's, you know, therapist and patient, and it's all talking about what's going on in that individual's life. It seems like you're trying to go beyond that to look at social connections. And as you mentioned, those intergenerational roots of problems. What does that look like in when you're dealing with someone and helping them work through these issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we need relational health, and many of us have relational deprivation. And when we go into counseling, we are coming in as ourself, but we are connected. Our stories are interconnected. We didn't get there into that office because something happened in isolation. We got there because of relationships that have been hurtful or experiences that have traumatized us, or we're trying to navigate. A lot of times you might look at something like anxiety or depression, but truly that's that, although people will say that that's a, might be the diagnosis, really that's a larger symptom of a root cause. And when you have communities who have experienced relentless colonization, genocide, enslavement, these things get passed forward. This unrest gets passed forward, and healing happens in community. Mourning happens collectively. And so it was a big piece of looking at mental health and how to heal from the generational impact of colonization, historical trauma, and systemic genocide. And then beginning to reflect on what would that process look like to decolonize the pedagogy of mental health and the Western framework that it is built upon. And that part makes it go in from an individual perspective to a collective experience of wellness and leaning into that.
Another obstacle a lot of people may see with mental health care is the cost. A lot of mm-hmm. people just plumb can't afford it. How do you tackle that?
Yeah, so that's, you know, it shouldn't cost you to heal. And it does. And unfortunately, we have commodified wellness to a point of making it inaccessible to our communities that need it the most. And when we look at what mental health and what it really offers in a traditional 12-week, say, session, that's only 12 hours of care if you get a full hour. And if you go to therapy, counseling individually for 1 year, you're getting about 48 hours. And if we reduce that down, that's a week and a half, 40-hour work week. It's a week and a half worth of therapy you get in a year. And in 2 years, it's 2.5 weeks and so forth. And so when we think about the cost of what we are putting into and the investment, to me, looking at mental health means being able to free the parts of it that make it inaccessible. And so I got into grant writing. I was not a grant writer, Rob. That was not what I was getting into. When I started Her Wellness, it was because I believed that we need to have an anti-racist and trauma-informed and culturally responsive approach to mental health. And I leaned into opening up this organization to provide free mental health and wellness services. I started out in my van, if you believe that, and going to community centers and organizations that would collaborate with me and bringing what I could for free. It was a lot of my family during that time, but I believed with all my heart that we could make this an accessible process for people. And in doing that, I ended up writing a lot of grants. A big grant that funded us was with the Department of Justice, VOCA grant, Victims of Crime. All of those who we serve are victims of crime, specifically looking at sexual assault, intimate partner violence, domestic violence, and human trafficking. And that's a big problem right now in our Indigenous communities, looking at how to heal and address the domestic violence and interpartner violence, and looking at ways to the system that needs to be able to help support the healing of our communities, such as Savannah's Act or looking at VAWA.
Do you see what you're doing as a model that other people could adopt, either working in the same geographical area that you are, but with maybe different groups, or going to other places where there are gaps in the mental health care system? What would you tell them to try to build on the model you're creating?
Yeah, the model that I'm creating is community informed, and we use practice-based medicine, which means that we really want to learn and gather information from our community, what's working, what's not working, what has always worked, and bring that as part of our practice. We also, as clinicians, are looking at how to change the dialogue around what mental health and the conversation around mental health and diagnostics looks like, using really that approach that embodies a post-colonial psychologies like liberation psychologies and practice-based medicines that are community-centered, and integrating our ancestral wisdoms and connection to our land and the things that heal us. So when I look at what people could do if they want to replicate what we're doing, one is to know I didn't really just build a center. The Institute is informed to activate. So I developed a term that's called community-activated medicine. It is informed to activate that the people are the medicine. And so we have partners with local universities who will send their students here who are in their clinical rotations for interning. And we bring in a responsive approach to teaching them how to work within the community, what it means to be part of a wellness system to integrate care. And then there, a lot of times that's who is providing the services and the direct services to our relatives. I don't use the word client. We use the word relative here because we are in relationship with one another. And so, yeah, I believe that what I am doing here can be replicated not only across the state, but across the nation. It's something that I think many of our BIPOC practitioners are looking into. How do we begin to have a shift in the paradigm of how we approach mental health and wellness? And how do we increase the accessibility within our communities so that they can get the resources that they need? And so I do believe that we can make this something that is offered in many different ways. We just have to begin to be willing to lean into shifting our framework around what mental health is, the delivery of the services that we offer, and begin to be more community-centered.
And Leah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Leah S. Denny is CEO and clinical director of Her Wellness Institute, which she founded in 2017. It provides free mental health care to Indigenous people and underserved people in the Milwaukee area. Coming up next news, then we'll talk about U.S. Representative Ron Kind's announcement yesterday that he won't seek re-election in 2022. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.